Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. When you think of West Virginia, you probably think of coal. But as the coal industry dies a slow death, Appalachia is now pulled in two different directions. On the one hand, natural gas fracking now dominates the Ohio River Valley, and countless miles of gas pipelines spread like spaghetti across the region. On the other hand, a growing network of activists are envisioning an entirely different future that moves beyond an extractive economy toward shared prosperity, lasting job growth, clean energy, and civic engagement. Today we talk with two people at the forefront of reshaping the direction of Appalachia. Ted Bettner is a senior researcher with the Ohio River Valley Institute. Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute in Seattle, and a frequent guest on Locus Focus, is also a research fellow at the Ohio River Valley Institute. Ted, welcome to Locus Focus, and Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus. And you've been on so much recently that I think maybe I'm going to make you a co-host of this show, Eric.
Thanks, Barbara. I've been waiting for that honor for some time, but I appreciate being back.
Well, we're going to be talking today about Appalachia, which is something we haven't talked about on this show very much at all. Actually, West Virginia's been in the news a lot the last couple of weeks because of your senator, Ted, good old Joe Manchin, who's become a very pivotal vote in a whole bunch of votes having to do with Biden's agenda for hopefully correcting a lot of the problems in the United States. So I wanted to start by talking about why Joe Manchin is the way he is and how much that's a reflection of the politics, the economy, the social structure of West Virginia.
Yeah, those are some big questions that have been in the making for decades. Senator Manchin started out as a state senator. He actually served with my dad in the legislature. He's from Marion County, which is a coal-producing county in the northern part of the state, near Morgantown, West Virginia, where West Virginia University is. He started out there, and then he ran for governor unsuccessfully in 1996. He lost to Charlotte Pritt, which was a very contentious election. And that was sort of the beginning of West Virginia sort of turning to a red state as well. From that period forward, I believe, we voted for the Republican presidential candidate every election since then. But before that, we were always a solid blue union state. We even voted for Mike Dukakis when he ran in 88. he was Secretary of State for a while. Then he had a term and a half as governor of the state of West Virginia before running for election as a U.S. state senator. This was right after Robert C. Byrd died. He appointed somebody to that seat for about a year. And so he's been there ever since. And what's interesting about now compared to the last, I think he got in the Senate in 2012 election is when he won. And he got into the seat 2013. So he's really never been in a position of power to make a difference. So when you're in the minority for that long, it's easy to not take action and do things. So this is a real test case for Senator Manchin to see what he can accomplish, because this isn't about stopping, the repeal of the ACA. This isn't about shooting cap and trade bills like he has in ads. This is about, whether he puts West Virginia first and delivers for the state being in such a pivotal position. There's article after article we've seen, king of the Senate, the most powerful person in the United States, because he is such a swing vote on just about everything. He just don't know where he's going to stand on stuff. And that largely is because, he's actually supported by labor to some extent, like the AFL-CIO in West Virginia and the Chamber of Commerce. So he's getting pulled in those very different directions, and he has been his entire life. When he served in the West Virginia legislature, he was the point person representative for ALEC, which is sort of a right-wing group that advances very conservative state legislation at the state and local level. But he's definitely Mr. Moderate. He takes the temperature. So it's going to be a big deal to see what he can do for the state.
I actually first heard of his name in connection with coal and one of your notorious coal companies that he seemed to have a lot of connections with. So am I correct about that, that he has some pretty strong ties with the coal industry?
Yeah, absolutely. He's a coal broker. Do you know what that is?
No. I'm from Oregon. I don't know about coal.
I'm always assuming everybody knows what these terms are, that are from West Virginia. Those are people that sell coal property, usually, by companies and things like that, put together deals for coal companies to lease and by coal. So he did that for a long time. He's also in a family business. His family was into, but he's become a very wealthy man. He's a millionaire, but he's never been somebody who's, he's always been sort of a, you know, Reagan Democrat, so to speak. He's been never too enthusiastic about using government to, you know, really better the lives of normal working class people. It's always about putting bipartisanship as an end in itself instead of good policy. But that could change. I mean, we don't know exactly what he'll do. And I think, you know, just recently, you know, he's blocked one confirmation of the OMB director, and then, but he's also approved the head of the new cabinet member of the Department of Interior, which he is a fairly progressive person. So you never know exactly what he's going to do. He gets pulled in a lot of directions, and he's in a state, you know, when Manchin started his career, it was probably one of the bluest states in the entire country. And now, I believe we were just shy of Wyoming as having the largest share of voters that pulled the lever for Trump in this past election. So the state has shifted dramatically over that time, and that's an even longer conversation.
When you said that you're waiting to see if he's going to put the interests of the state of West Virginia in front of everything else, what would that mean?
Well, I mean, one thing, we had the late Senator Robert C. Byrd had a lot of faults, you know, but he also grew as a person while he was in office. You know, I think he was one of the best critics against the Iraq War and against other things late in his career. But one thing Robert C. Byrd did when he became appropriations chair of, became a chair of the Appropriations Committee, is he brought billions and billions of dollars back to West Virginia. You can't go 10 miles in West Virginia on any road and not see something that Robert C. Byrd helped bring back to the state, whether it's the Health Sciences Center at West Virginia University, whether it's major highways, whether it's training centers, NASA, the FBI Center in Fairmont, West Virginia, or the Green Bank Observatory, Radio Observatory. I mean, just billions and billions of dollars and thousands of jobs that he brought here through his stewardship as being the chair of the Appropriations Committee and in other capacities as well. And I think that was due to the fact, too, that West Virginia has probably given more to the American dream than just about any other state, but it's received less in return. It's been a sacrifice zone, sort of colonial state that's been ruled by outside interests for so long. So much of the land was owned by outside coal corporations and other people, and the minerals along with themselves. All of the you know, probably several trillion dollars, you know, of coal, gas, and oil have been pulled out of the state, and the state has just seen little in return. It's one of the poorest states in the country. So Byrd used that as an opportunity to make sure that he could do the best for West Virginia in terms of bringing in federal investment. And I think the big question is Senator Manchin is in a critical position right now. I mean, I think if he asked for $150 billion of investments over 10 years in West Virginia, I think he'd get it because he's such a swing vote. I mean, they need him absolutely. If they lose Manchin, they don't have it unless they can get a moderate Republican to go along with it. So he's just in a very pivotal position. And I'm optimistic that he will do what's right for West Virginia. I have to be. And we're working on that as we speak to ensure that West Virginia is at the table instead of on the menu when it comes to climate change legislation.
Eric, I want to turn to you now. We've been mostly talking with you on the show about climate issues and fossil fuel issues in the Northwest. So I know that you're now actually a research fellow with the Ohio Valley Institute, and you're doing a lot of work with Ted about what's going on in Appalachia. So I was wondering, what drew you to Appalachia, and what are you finding out now in your new position?
It's a great question. So I'm basically splitting myself into two halves that feel sometimes pretty coherent and sometimes pretty different. So as you know, in the Pacific Northwest, I still head up the Thin Green Line team at Sightline, working principally on stopping new infrastructure development for fossil fuels in the Northwest. And then in Appalachia, I get to work alongside Ted at the Ohio River Valley Institute, which from my way of thinking right now, I mean, it's a politically and culturally different region, but it is probably the most politically pivotal point in the United States right now. I mean, if you look at Western Pennsylvania, it was in the Klieg lights for the entire back half of the election cycle. West Virginia with Senator Manchin, of course, we've talked about prominent senators in Ohio and obviously Kentucky and Pennsylvania as well. And so the discussions that we're having in that region about energy, which has been historically fossil fuel dependent, extremely fossil fuel oriented, and about what a new version of the economy looks like in some ways, like the conversation that's happening in that region, in my judgment, is the most important conversation that's happening in the country around energy and the economy. And so, I think one of the things that I think Ted does a really good job of talking about that I've learned a lot about is about kind of the history of the labor movement and the history of the progressive movement in Appalachia, which was, I mean, there is a profound and I think really kind of moving history there of the formation of some of the strongest unions in the country who actually physically went to war, put their lives on the line, were killed. And the sort of, colonial structure of some parts of that region. And I think colonial is not too strong a word to use. It's an example of what happens when kind of predaceous coal industry companies or others get a hold of the land base and extract resources and treat the people who are working in those places as a form of natural resource. And Ted has for years done incredibly valuable work kind of making the case for a broad rethinking of politics in West Virginia. I'll let him talk about all that, but I find the work there to be incredibly exciting. I'm an outsider, obviously, but hopefully there are little things I can do here and there to kind of help advance the work in some of those states.
Well, it seems that in the work that you've done in the Northwest to try to stop fossil fuel development from turning, I remember one time you talked about you didn't want the Northwest to become like the Gulf Coast. And particularly in West Virginia, it seems like it is, in fact, a scenario that you've been working for the last 15 years or so to try to stop here in the Northwest. I wonder if you see a connection between what you've been trying to stop in the Northwest and what you're working on now in West Virginia and in the Ohio River Valley to transform.
I mean, I do see connections. And I made those remarks about the Gulf Coast after some folks had asked me to go down to Louisiana for a little while and spend some time advising on some coal export developments and other developments in that bottom part of the river below New Orleans. What I realized after a short visit there was I didn't have that much to contribute because the politics were so hostile to the way I was thinking about things. I wish I could go do that, spend some time there again now. I think I've gotten maybe a little bit smarter in my old age. I think about where the Northwest was 10 years ago. When we had proposals for 150 million tons of coal exports out of Oregon, Washington, and British Columbia. Like that is a big number, even by Appalachia standards. Proposals for what, a dozen oil by rail facilities, including the biggest in the country, three major petrochemical refineries, including some of the biggest in the world, on and on and on. You've heard this litany a million times. I don't think it's an exaggeration at all to say, there are plenty of examples through the course of history where you take a region that hasn't been, particularly enmeshed in the energy industry, that is, reasonably progressive, although it's complicated. And the energy industry, in my judgment, generally doesn't, the fossil fuel industry has not generally brought, sweetness and light alongside it. I don't think there's any guarantee that any region stays the way that it is now. I mean, the history of resource extraction, we have a different version of that in the Northwest. It's largely about the timber industry. We kind of create the politics and we create the culture and we protect the environment the way that we will, but it has to be sort of an active process. It's really interesting to think about the voting pattern shift in a place like West Virginia, which went from, that's the kind of the birthplace of the American labor movement in many ways with Mother Jones and people fighting on Blair Mountain, to a place that's, I think, what, plus 35 for Trump in the last election. That's not incoherent at all. And I think, Ted and some others in the region have done a really good job kind of helping me understand why things have played out in that way. And I think it connects very much to the Northwest and what, our possible futures could look like in this region.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with Ted Bettner, who's with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute and the Ohio River Valley Institute as well. One of the things that struck me in some of the articles I was reading on your website, Ted, was one that described the spaghetti of pipelines, natural gas pipelines that just expands throughout the Ohio River Valley. And I wanted to talk about maybe that as a starting point for what is already in place in terms of infrastructure. I think people know about mountaintop removal mining and all the, before that, the strip mining that went on in West Virginia. But how has West Virginia transitioned from being primarily a coal state to being now a hub of natural gas I guess, fracking and distribution.
Yeah, I mean, the irony in West Virginia is that, you know, it's like trying to choose Coke and Pepsi. You know, the huge deposits, huge shale deposits that, you know, that have been developed over the last decade have displaced actually a lot of the coal and where it used to go. States like North Carolina that used to import, you know, 12, 15 million tons of West Virginia coal now don't import barely anything and now run more on natural gas. And it's natural gas that's coming from states like West Virginia. So the decline of the coal industry is tied up prominently with the shale development that's taken place in Appalachia. And that's the real irony, especially when politicians sometimes talk about we need all of the above, you know, and that's sort of like Coke or Pepsi. It doesn't really work that way. But the decline of coal, I mean, is, you know, is we did a report, gosh, back in 2010, and we got raked over the coals for saying that coal is going to decline. We were just using government figures to put that out. But that's a controversial thing to say in West Virginia. But the shift, you know, has happened mainly because the seams have gotten so thin in the coal in West Virginia, and it's become less productive, and that increased prices and allowed Wyoming to really produce coal in the late 90s and early 2000s, and then Illinois came on board to really start producing a lot of coal and outcompeted West Virginia for production. And then shale gas on top of that. I always say shale gas kind of ended mountaintop removal in West Virginia because it just made gas so much more competitive. And the mining in West Virginia has actually shifted from the southern traditional coal fields that you hear about, the mine wars and those things, up to the northern part of the state. So now the coal and gas fields are kind of right on top of each other. In a county like Marshall County that produces the most gas and most coal in the state, it is also a large gas producer as well. So you have that interplay happening. And the southern part of the state has just been absolutely devastated. West Virginia is the only state that has lost population since 1950. And we have also lost about 60,000 people over the last decade in the state as well. And that's largely based upon the aging population, but that huge decline of coal in the southern part of the state. And what's happened now, too, is the politics of the state have changed. You know, coal was always king for all the years. I mean, you know, I still worked at the legislature. Coal got basically everything it wanted. You know, we used to always joke around West Virginia that there's only one political party in West Virginia, and that's the Coal, Oil, and Gas Party, the COG Party. And there's two factions of that party. There's Democrats and Republicans. But they tend to do pretty good. I mean, you know, for all sorts of purposes, up until the late 90s, West Virginia Democrats, you know, we're pretty good on most other issues, fairly liberal on issues outside of coal and gas. You got into those issues and there was, you know, that's much more thornier. But the politics have shifted. I think the Oil and Gas Association is now king. They have much more control over the politics of the state. You know, I think Mark Twain always said that history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. But in West Virginia, it actually repeats because we've been through this story of, again, of the booms and busts of the coal industry. And now we're seeing the same thing happen with the gas industry. It was almost like a curse. I mean, they call it the resource curse when places that have economies that are dominated by the extractive industry, it tends to push out other types of investment, and it leads to sort of a disinvestment in the areas where it happens. Because the companies, for all intents and purposes, want to get their coal, stick their straw in the ground, get the gas out, and get out. They don't want to develop the area. So, you know, Eric and I have always talked about, too, that West Virginia is a place that's had lots of economic growth, but has not had a lot of economic development, like really good infrastructure and a real knowledge-based economy to attract other types of capital to the region. So it's always suffered from that as well. But the change has been significant. And up until a couple of years ago, it was gas pipeline construction that was some of the best jobs in the state, paying $100,000, $150,000 a year. They've completed one. There's been several that have been stopped, Atlantic Coast Pipeline being one of them. So, but the irony too with that is, like, you know, even if you build the pipelines, which don't create very many jobs after they're already, you know, in the ground, so we'll just be shipping more of that gas out of state, and it doesn't benefit the state as well. We export upwards of 90% of all of our gas and coal, if you include electricity production along with that. One of the big things that we're trying to do at ORVI, at the Ohio River Valley Institute, is really offer an alternative strategy for that type of development. You know, we have a real opportunity in West Virginia because we haven't developed natural gas in terms of electricity use and car use and things like that. we can actually sort of leapfrog from coal straight to renewables. And that's an opportunity that we have, because the coal plants that we have in our state are going to begin to start shutter, along with the jobs as well. But we do have one coal plant that's fairly new, actually less than 20 years old. But it does offer an opportunity to do something else. And, you know, the irony too is West Virginia is just an absolutely gorgeous state. You know, every weekend I try to get outside and hike or ski or run or go to a state park, and they're just great. There's barely anybody there too. It's nothing like going, you know, living in New England or Denver or places like that where there's just people everywhere. So it's a real beautiful state in that sense, but it's also very scarred. And one of the things that we've been looking at is, you know, huge mine reclamation and plugging oil and gas wells could create tens of thousands of jobs in the region while cleaning up the state, because West Virginia is really never going to thrive until we clean up the mess over the last 150 years.
Well, I wanted to talk some about that scarring. That's one of the impressions that I have of the little that I know about West Virginia. I think back to when I learned about strip mining, which was back in the early 70s, and how West Virginia was really devastated by that. And then mountaintop removal mining seemed to take it to a whole new level of horror. And I wonder if you can describe what is on the ground now in West Virginia as a result of all the coal mining that went on, and what's happening now with natural gas development could increase that kind of scarring.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, just to give you an idea, I mean, there's billions of dollars of just liability based on the abandoned gas wells that we talked about. These huge fracking wells, you know, they're bonded at just a fraction of the cost that it's going to take to reclaim these sites and to plug these wells. And that presents huge liabilities going forward, but also it presents opportunities to, you know, do something about that. You know, the coal and gas industry have been through lots of waves before in the state. And I think when you look at the coal industry, you know, where it started from, like you talked about strip mining, you know, back in the 70s, that was very controversial. And there's always, you know, when Jay Rockefeller ran for governor and he was against strip mining, he lost very soundly against Arch Moore. He learned not to do that again, unfortunately. And then he won when he supported it. And mountaintop removal in the 90s became a real flashpoint and a source of a lot of angst for people. And it ended up pitting environmentalists versus, you know, people in the labor movement. So it was a real bad thing. I used to always joke around and say West Virginia, you know, coal made West Virginia blue, but then it made it red. Made it blue in the beginning because that was the central organizing way people in these communities banded together to form unions, you know, to build, you know, a better life for themselves. But eventually when climate change came along, especially in the late 90s during the Kyoto Protocol and things like that, it became a real flashpoint. And that we saw that division politically in the state. And that is one of the major reasons the state's turned blue is the coal reason.
Well, Eric, I see some parallels. I'm wondering if you agree between the struggle in West Virginia to deal with the powers that the mining industry has, compare that to the power that the timber industry has in the Northwest. And I'm wondering if you are able to bring lessons from the timber wars in the Northwest to West Virginia as they're dealing with the residue of the fossil fuel wars.
I think that analogy is always sort of shadowing my thoughts all the time. I mean, I was sort of coming into consciousness politically, you know, during the timber wars in the 90s. I wasn't really active in the environmental movement until, you know, a little bit after the kind of the timber wars. I'm not quite old enough for, I missed the good part of that fight. But there are some obvious parallels between it because, you know, the timber industry was obviously very politically powerful, and it was kind of in the quote unquote the right places to exert significant legislative dominance in both Oregon and Washington and beyond as well. If you grew up around here, as I did, and you were, you know, as a kid, remember driving through the Olympic Peninsula or the Oregon coast, or my whole family's from logging communities in Southern Oregon, but it turned huge, huge tracts of forest into, it looked like Verdun after, you know, World War One. I mean, it was just wrecked the landscape, wrecked the salmon streams. Like those forests will never come back in our lifetime or maybe ever, in the way that they were. And so, you know, watching that level of environmental destruction combined with the political power of the industry was tough. But, you know, one of the things that I think a lot of folks in the environmental community in the Northwest would agree with is that, in a sense, we sort of won the battle and lost the war, like, you know, through the Northwest Forest Plan and through changes in the global timber markets, a lot of that clear cutting and exporting of raw timber for processing elsewhere, a lot of that stopped, not entirely, but a lot of it stopped. But what happened is a legacy of resentment and political challenges that are still with us today. And you could probably name a dozen places in Oregon, and I can name a dozen places in Washington where there are still very hard feelings about what was, I think somewhat incorrectly, but is perceived to be the kind of muscle power of the urbanized area in this, of the state exerting control over the economies of rural places. And I think it's no accident that a lot of those places, and I think of Hoquiam a lot, I think of Longview a lot, but Coos Bay is part of the story too. The economy kind of never came back after the timber economy collapsed. Unemployment is still high. There's still profound social problems in some of those areas. And those are the very same places that were targeted for fossil fuel infrastructure development. Longview is probably the single best case of like what hasn't been proposed for Longview. It's hard to think of. You know, it's petrochemical refineries, it's oil train proposals, it's coal export terminals, one after the other. And it's because there isn't a vibrant economy in Cowlitz County that can offer a plausible alternative. And so, you know, the big challenge, and I think we see it writ large in West Virginia and parts of Pennsylvania and Ohio, Kentucky, is we have to develop an economy that works for people, that does have plausible alternatives, that actually does provide real local prosperity, isn't vaporware. Because, you know, until that happens, you know, a few jobs working construction on a pipeline or what have you is going to seem pretty attractive.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Ted Bettner, who's with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and Eric DePlace with Setline Institute and the Ohio River Valley Institute as well. Now, Eric, the places that you mentioned in Southwest Washington and in Oregon that are being the targets of a lot of fossil fuel development, which also really experienced the brunt of the decline of the timber industry, have had an interesting resurgence after turning into pretty strong, conservative, kind of reactive communities with the onslaught of fossil fuel development being proposed, particularly in Coos Bay and in Cowlitz County. There seems to be an emergent movement of activists who are, well, some of them are very progressive, and some of them are conservatives who are aligning with progressives because they have a shared interest, for instance, in stopping the Pacific Connector gas pipeline. And I remember you saying several times how you love the fossil fuel fights because it really organizes people and it uplifts communities. So I'm wondering if one of your missions in the Ohio River Valley is to share the experiences in the Northwest with the kind of organizing that has really galvanized communities in positive ways.
I think there's a dimension of that for sure. But here's a couple of lessons I think I can share. So one is, I think you're absolutely right that a lot of the sort of local and rural communities that are, you know, reasonably or fairly conservative in Northwest terms have developed their own level of activism in opposition to the fossil fuel fights. I mean, that's in evidence everywhere. I always think about Hoquiam. Hoquiam was a major timber center. The economy's been tough for a long time there. There were three oil train proposals that would have built export terminals there. And it was without really any contribution from the regional environmental movement or anybody from outside. The city council of Hoquiam unanimously banned crude oil storage. And I didn't even know about it until I read about it in the paper. Somebody had sent me an email and I was like, this cannot possibly be right. But it was that kind of confluence of a serious threat hanging over people's heads and a local community kind of developing their own approach to dealing with that threat. And we've seen that kind of pop up again and again. You know, and so I think there are lessons that apply, or at least in broad sort of analogical terms, between the Northwest fights and what's going on in the Ohio Valley. But there are also some profound differences. And I think one of the differences, from my point of view, is that the legacy of resource extraction goes deep there. It's long. It's been there for a long time. I mean, we are, in a sense, in the Northwest fortunate because our mineral resources are actually very poor. We have some oil refineries, but we don't produce any oil, gas, or coal in the state anymore, or in Oregon. I guess there's a tiny bit of gas in Oregon, but it's minuscule. And that's not true in Western Pennsylvania. It's not true in West Virginia. And so, you know, I think you have to approach it a little bit differently because kind of historically and culturally, it powered the economy for a long time. I mean, Pittsburgh was a steel city for a long time because there's a lot of anthracite around there that people really mind. So I think there are lessons, but I mean, I try to be, at least maybe Ted can correct me, but cautious about overdrawing the lessons between the two places, because they do have pretty different histories in a lot of ways, in my opinion.
Well, Ted, what lessons are you drawing from Eric, and where are you teaching him?
Tread with caution, Eric. No, I'm just kidding. No, I think Eric hit the nail on the head. I mean, Cole in West Virginia is in the High River Valley too, and in southeast Ohio, northwest Pennsylvania, and West Virginia as well. It's as much cultural as it is economic, but it's really true. I mean, it's on our state flag. It's, you know, West Virginia has been a poor state, and from a lot of outsiders, it might be looked down as like not as bad as Mississippi, but the one thing the state has always been able to do is power this country, whether it's through two world wars, the Industrial Revolution, and we've been very proud of that history of going into dangerous places and producing something that the world needs. And that's a lot to look back on and be proud of. So it's a mixed history. I look at it as sort of a Greek tragedy because, you know, even when we had company towns, like you can see in the movie Matewan, which I highly recommend if you get a chance, you know, it brought people together and families. It helped create a cultural cohesion of people working together side by side in solidarity. Where people, you know, bowled together and had picnics and went to church together. It created such a sense of community at the same time that these struggles were happening. And when you start going into these places and there's not too much going on outside of coal mining and you're threatening to take that away, people are rightfully going to fight you on that. And so I think you have to understand that. And these are sources, because of unions, are sources of good paying jobs. You know, a typical coal miner in West Virginia makes $75,000 to $100,000 a year, an underground coal miner. So that's a lot of money for somebody who typically does not have a college degree or even an associate's degree. And those are hard to come by. So taking that out of the community, you're going to be hit with something else. And it becomes really hard in West Virginia and the region as a whole just to sort of help people understand that something else is possible. Because it's a region that's so reliant on the fossil fuel industry. They don't see solar panels. They're beginning to see more wind, but they don't see their friends working at these places. So they don't really have an understanding of how things could transition there. It makes it much more difficult to do that type of organizing in those places.
So what kind of organizing are you doing? How do you go about trying to bridge the gap between the future that you believe is vital that we move towards, which is a renewable future, and the past, which people are still living in the present moment, which is a fossil fuel reality?
Well, I'm gonna jump in and talk out of school for 1 second. So Ted and I, in addition to working together at the Ohio River Valley Institute, we also are involved in an enterprise called Reimagine Appalachia that's doing, I think, some really neat work to kind of just not in sort of just loose, ambiguous terms, but in really specific, concrete ways, describe what a renewed economy could look like in Appalachia, what federal investment could look like, what it could produce, and kind of how it might provide a stronger economy that begins to transition. And so, like, I'll let Ted go now because he knows actually much more about the work and is producing some really interesting research in support of that endeavor. But it's convinced me that there is a huge green grass of opportunity in front of us right now in that region. And so Ted, maybe you want to talk about Reimagine Appalachia a little bit. I think it's really interesting.
Yeah, it's sort of a broad coalition and campaign to ensure that the region is at the table instead of on the menu when it comes to looking at climate change. And we know climate change legislation at the federal level is going to be wrapped up in, you know, COVID relief bills. It's going to be wrapped up into a very large infrastructure bill that will pass probably this year. You know, we're talking $2-4 trillion. So this campaign is about making sure that West Virginia, but the Kentucky, West Virginia, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, like, to make sure they get the best deal possible. When we're talking about that, we're talking about clean manufacturing. We're talking about investing, ensuring that everybody has access to universal broadband, which so many people in this region do not have access to. We're talking about, you know, modernizing the grid. We're talking about repairing all the damage from the past, whether it's coal ash, abandoned coal mines, or plugging gas wells. And we're also looking at energy efficiency, making sure that we have some of the most inefficient housing in the entire country. So there's enormous opportunities to help this region transform. We've done a number of reports. We've been working with UMass Amherst professor there by the name of Bob Poland, and he's done three studies that have looked at West Virginia, Kentucky, and Pennsylvania that have looked at the job creation that can happen if we make these investments, public investments and private investments in the region. So it's been quite dramatic, and it's really picking up steam. Like mayors in West Virginia that I never thought would come out supporting, you know, clean energy and an alternative vision for economic development have. Several in West Virginia. Yeah, it's been pretty amazing in that sense.
How much buy-in do you have from the communities around the state for really starting to think in terms of a renewable future?
Yeah, I mean, there's people on the ground that do the sort of organizing, and they're part of the coalition that we're part of. I'm sort of just like the policy wonk. You know, I work on the research and analysis and that kind of thing. But there is, I can just give you an idea, like Raleigh County, West Virginia, where Beckley is, one of the biggest coal producing places in the state. They are installing a 100, which is kind of small, but a 100 megawatt solar utility scale system there in the county. And that's if you would have told me that 10 years ago, I'd never have believed you, because it was so interesting to see them support that. And I think it's as those coal jobs have declined, Barbara, and they haven't come back, people are becoming more and more open to alternative type of development. But it's also about meeting people where they are. We don't want to retrain people for jobs that don't exist, and we don't want people to have to relocate when they don't want to. So meeting people where they are, having a big dose of humility, and listening to people is the best way, and to build trust. And that's how you work at a community level to get people, and you listen to them for the ideas of what we can do.
A few years ago, I read this book called Coal Wars, and I don't recall the writer, but it was a very interesting book, and it was looking at all these different facets of what the kind of work that you're doing. I remember one of the things that struck me was in the diverging opinions that were trying to come together, and there was a school of thought that thought that the mountaintop removal mining was a great thing for West Virginia because it took these rugged mountainous areas that you couldn't develop and just flattened them out because you cut off the mountaintops and you throw what was the top of the mountain into the river valleys, and it's all level. And then you can put in playing fields and build towns and stuff like that. And I mean, I'm reading that and just kind of aghast that somebody would think that's a good thing. And it seemed like, from the way that this author was describing it, that environmentalists were having to kind of work with that mentality and try to negotiate with it. And I'm wondering if you find yourself in that kind of position.
In some ways, I mean, I think when it came to those sites, we know for a fact now, because almost all the mountaintop removal is gone. I mean, they're not mining coal. They're not doing that. There's a couple sites. For the most part, it's not happening. And none of those things ever happened. There's maybe a golf course here on one of them, I think, in Mingo County. But they were never redeveloped. And all those promises that were made, like you would know, they didn't happen. Because it's very difficult to redevelop on a mountaintop removal site because it's a very unstable surface. And you don't want to build on it. But there are efforts to do things on those sites. But for the most part, I mean, I think when it comes to gas, some of the analysis that we've done shows you that it creates so little jobs. It is such a capital intensive industry where it's fascinating to see like people who are actually involved in the oil gas extraction itself. It's 2,000 people in West Virginia. You know, it's only about 12,000 in the region. I mean, it's very small, and it's because it's mostly done, you know, with huge capital equipment and machines. And all of that value that's produced from that, whether it's natural gas liquids or dry gas, is pushed out of the state and it's processed, and very little people benefit from it. So, I mean, the good news on that side is that because few people are benefiting from it, they don't gravitate to like they do coal. I mean, coal employs a hell of a lot more people, by the energy content of it. It just employs a lot more people, and gas just does not. It's extremely productive. And that's driven down prices. You know, that's why the gas industry is having such a rough time right now, is because there's an oversupply of gas. It's too cheap. And, you know, people in communities around here aren't seeing any multiple jobs based on that. We're not seeing people manufacturing things for the gas industry. We're not seeing, like we did with the coal industry, we're not seeing those value-added things that can happen. In some cases, nor do we want to see those either, because of the pollution and the externalities and the health effects of all of these things are just detrimental. And the bottom line too, the same with coal. I mean, they push out other industries. When you have extractive industries, nobody wants to be near them. And nobody's going to invest in those areas. So you get a very undiverse economy that tends to grow with the booms and busts. But over the long run, it just doesn't grow as fast.
You're talking about how, I guess, coal is part of the state flag. I mean, it's such an important part of the culture of West Virginia. And it's something that Donald Trump really played up 4 years ago when he was campaigning in West Virginia. And I'm going to bring back coal. And I'm wondering how many people in West Virginia are still waiting for Donald Trump. I guess he's supposed to now be inaugurated on March 4th, according to QAnon. So people are still waiting for him to come back and bring back coal.
I mean, I think for most people, I mean, this is where we need to listen and talk to people, because for some people, rightfully or wrongfully, they thought, you know, that he could do that and that he was willing to fight for coal, right? You know, at least he was willing to fight, where the Democrat, Hillary, called them deplorables. So that doesn't go over well with any working class people of any color and anywhere in this country, probably, getting called that and being told that we're going to lose a lot of coal jobs. You know, I think the way that we're trying to deal with it in West Virginia is, like, we are going to continue to lose coal jobs and we're probably going to lose gas jobs. But we are trying to work to redevelop the area and work with entrepreneurs and other type of investments that can rebuild the entire region. I mean, I think that's the difference. But some people, I guarantee you, if you take somebody from Portland, Oregon or something, if they go down to Mingo County and hang out with the local UMWA union there for 20 minutes, they will understand why people in that region fought so hard to keep coal. These are good people. I think they get dismissed often too, because, you know, that it's Trump country or those things. It's much more complicated than that. When we dismiss an entire group of people in that way, I think we lose out on really getting to understand what's happening.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with Ted Bettner, who's with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute and also the Ohio River Valley Institute. Well, there's a lot of talk about just transition, and that's one of the things that I'm getting a sense in Biden's whole plan for bringing the United States probably into the 21st century. And how is that being portrayed in West Virginia? Are people in West Virginia being shown that there is a way to have a just transition away from coal and towards renewables?
I think there's tremendous promise in the package of legislation that will come out of economic recovery, infrastructure investment, maybe climate policy, that has the ability to inject a ton of money, of just cash and investment from the federal government into Appalachia and begin to build new infrastructure, broadband, highways, rail, maybe, you know, renewable energy, energy efficiency. All that stuff is viable. It creates jobs. It creates a different sort of mentality. Ted is obviously much more knowledgeable than I am about the sort of specific uptake by people in the state. But my sense as an outsider is that a lot of this stuff is becoming more real. And there's a lot of stuff that's right around the corner. So I will bet you $20 that if we have this conversation in a year from now, things look sort of more positive than they do right now. I'm feeling pretty optimistic about it. And some of that, I think, is, you know, it's because I'm hanging out with people like Ted and hanging out with people at Reimagine Appalachia and kind of seeing how much potential there is in the region. I mean, as Ted points out, West Virginia is a gorgeous state. There's a lot of potential in a place like that. I'll stop talking because I want to give the floor back to Ted, who actually knows what he's talking about.
Actually, Eric, we'll come back in a year and we'll maybe give you $20, I hope. Anyway.
I mean, one of the things too, I mean, I think, you know, West Virginia, you know, about 10% of the coal it digs, you know, it burns itself for electricity. And we can do that if we want to and probably pay more for electricity costs going forward. But other states are not buying our coal. You know, they're buying the metallurgical coal, but not the steam coal. And that's going to continue to decline. And if other states like Virginia have said, you know, we're going to go on 100% renewable energy by 2050, 2045. If North Carolina is doing that, if Pennsylvania is doing that, they're looking at a program too. You know, all these other states take this action. There's nothing we can do. We have to deal with that reality. And I think a lot of people in the state are beginning to understand that, you know, we can want coal all we want, but other people have to buy it. So we have to embrace that reality. And I think what we're hoping to, and why, you know, I have so much sympathy and empathy with people, you know, that aren't that far from me that have, you know, that have been in these coal dependent regions, is people just want a good paying job with benefits and be able to support their family and put food on the table. And coal pays very well. And some of these sort of green jobs don't quite pay as much. And that's something we have to figure out and do. The broader point that I try to get across when talking to community groups is that we're on this trajectory right now where coal is going to continue to decline. And even if we doubled up on oil and gas, we said we're going to keep investing in oil and gas and we want everything, we are going to end up in a worse place than if we decided to go another route, which is to begin to develop a clean energy economy like other states. We are going to be in a much better position economically. Our families are going to be better off. Our communities are going to be better off if we do that. And I think, like Eric said, come back in a year or two, more and more people are going to understand that, especially when they start to see you know, some of this investment in the region taking off and people, more people working as, you know, HVAC people, electricians that are doing, you know, energy efficiencies, whether it's, you know, broadband or people repairing all the damage of the past. When these things start taking off and people see the material benefits, they will jump on board. Same way as they did with the New Deal.
So do you see some of the signs that that's already happening?
Our legislature, you know, was for 83 years was democratically controlled, and then it flipped in 2014, and now Republicans have a super majority, and I'm talking most of the Republicans that are in a leadership position in our legislature. My grandfather, who was Republican, wouldn't recognize any of them. You know, I mean, they are pretty far to the right. And even given that, they have passed legislation to allow more solar generation in the state. They are embracing a lot of climate energy policies. And it's one of the reasons for them is because businesses are looking at West Virginia and say, well, you guys don't have any opportunities for clean energy. And if I'm running we've made commitments as whether we're Walmart, Target, or it doesn't matter. We've made commitments to use clean energy. So that has helped out dramatically. So if businesses are making those commitments, lawmakers in our state are also being more and more open to that. And once people can see the development and feel like their community is benefiting from it, I think that's when it'll really take off.
What kind of reputation does your organization have around the state? Do people see you as some kind of dangerous radical socialist tree huggers?
I think we've only been around since, when did we launch, Eric? August?
August, yeah. So Ohio Valley Institute's pretty new. So we're still making our reputation. We're probably annoying a few people right now, but I'm happy for it. But Ted was executive director of a budget and policy center in West Virginia. He goes back a long way. So he's got a sterling reputation all by himself that he can use to clean up reputational damage that I'm causing around the state.
You gotta watch out for these socialists from Seattle. Actually, you're from an anarchist jurisdiction, which designation was just lifted yesterday.
I saw that in the paper, right? We're no longer an anarchist jurisdiction, so I feel
neither
much
is
safer.
Portland. I'm so happy to no longer live in an anarchist jurisdiction. Every time I talk to somebody, it's hard to not think about the fact that we're now living in under a Biden administration as opposed to a Trump administration. And I just wonder what you're both hoping for in the coming months, years of hopefully some kind of shift from what we've been enduring for the last 4 years, and particularly how that's going to affect your community, Ted, in Appalachia.
I mean, I think it's hard to say. I mean, you know, typically, I think presidents have 2 years, right, in order to get something done over the finish line. And I think Obama made some serious mistakes, did some good things in his first 2 years, but a lot of the difference it made was 4 or 6 years later. Like the Affordable Care Act didn't really go into place until 2014, you know, to a while after it was enacted and there was lawsuits. So, I mean, I think this current administration understands that, which is great. And I think they haven't been deficit hawks like Obama was, you know, really trying to, you know, talk about that all the time. There is a need to, like, win, because chances are the Republicans will probably take over the Senate or the House in 2 years. I mean, that's what history has shown. It's very difficult to maintain that. So they have really 2 strong years to really make a difference in people's lives. And I think if they don't, it could just cause further disenchantment with the party and more people not taking part in the process. Because I think we've reached a real boiling point on just a whole host of issues, whether it's the racism around the country, whether it's the lack of people with health care, whether it's debt, financial insecurity, a lack of community that people feel. And in West Virginia, people are just in tremendous amounts of pain. You know, we lead the country in opioid deaths, what are called deaths of despair, like suicide, alcoholism. People are living not as long as they used to, which is absolutely crazy. And people are really fed up. So I think if things don't begin to change and get better in people's lives, things could get a lot worse. And I, you know, the biggest thing too is just we have to get to know people and meet people where they are, especially working class people. And unfortunately, a lot of these discussions that, you know, happen in progressive politics happen people with college degrees, happen people that are, you know, trained or professional activists. And I think we really need to talk to people and work with people that aren't engaged in that process, because, you know, culturally, a lot of liberals don't have much in common these days with working class people. They might agree on some of these economic issues, but culturally, they're very far apart. And I think that's where this disconnect's happening. So I think engaging in that and meeting people where they are and talking to them can make a huge difference.
Well, Eric, what are you learning from working in West Virginia? Because you come from a liberal bubble in Seattle. I'm sure it's like a lot of cultural changes that you recognize when you're dealing with West Virginia.
I've lived my whole life in Seattle or in the suburbs, although I won't bore everybody, but I grew up in a very conservative household. But I think Ted really puts his finger right on the main issue. I mean, we have a country that's obviously very polarized. There's been plenty of discussion about that. But I think a really profound lack of understanding kind of cross-culturally and cross-politically and cross-geographies. And I do think there's a very serious dislocation right now. I mean, I do not believe that all 70 million people or whomever who voted for Donald Trump are bad people. I simply don't believe that at all. And being able to figure out how we can advance a progressive policy agenda, which is what I want to do, and how we can address and speak, you know, in a serious way to the imperatives of climate change, and also lift people up and understand that the backgrounds and experiences that people have in different regions, including fossil fuel dependent regions, maybe especially fossil fuel dependent regions, those lives and those stories and those values need to be honored. And I think that's the profound work in some ways that both precedes politics and is post-politics. It's hard to describe a little bit, but I think that's in some ways the most important kind of work that we're hoping to do. You know, it's not about opposing this pipeline or building this solar panel factory. It's about kind of rebuilding a new American belief or a new American mythology or a new American sort of sense of community. And that's really where I'd like to see the work go over the long term. You know, I can play maybe a small role in that, but it will only ever be a small role.
I wonder how that's also going to inform the work you're doing in the Northwest now.
It's definitely complicated my worldview. I'll say that. Like, it's, you know, that's one of the great things about getting to spend time with folks in Appalachia is it does make me think. You know, you've heard me plenty of times. I can get pretty self-righteous about fossil fuels, and I've sort of enjoyed doing that as a career for a long time. But it does make me think a lot harder and a lot more about the nuance of the lived experience of communities for whom that is livelihood. That's community. That's history. And I think that's the project we need to all engage in is a different form of understanding and a different form of recognition. Just because you want a petrochemical facility in Kalima does not make you a bad person. It makes you necessarily, although there are maybe a couple exceptions to that. But people are coming at this stuff, I think, with a basic sense of decency and kind of want the same things. They want a good life for their family and they want a good future for their kids and all that. But it's hard work. It's hard work that is not helped by are sort of polarized, hyper-partisan. It's not helped by social media, in my opinion. And so, you know, moving into a different kind of conversation is really useful. And I think, you know, this radio interview, Barbara, I think it maybe can be a part of that. I think it's useful.
Well, I hope so. Anyway, it's very good talking to both of you guys. And I would like to stay in touch with you, Ted, and have you on periodically. Well, thanks a whole lot, Eric and Ted, for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Barbara. It's nice to see you again.
Thanks, Barbara.
We've been talking with Ted Bettner and Eric DePlace with the Ohio River Valley Institute, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. Next week, we'll talk with forest activist Samantha Kropp about the intersection of forest defense and climate justice. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Kathy Mattea. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.
Traveling on down that Coal Town Road, listen to my rubber tires whine. Goodbye to Buckeye, white sycamore, I'm leaving you behind. Oh, I've been a coal miner all my life, laying down track in the hole. Got a back like ironwood, bent by the wind, blood veins as blue as the coal. But veins as blue as the coal. Well, somebody said that's a strange tattoo you have on the side of your head. I said that's a blue mark left by the coal. Little more and I'd have been dead. Oh, I love the rumble. Lord, I love the cool of the sleigh. But it's going down that new road, looking for a job, traveling and looking ahead, traveling and looking ahead.